Part 1. Dagenmak hated silence. Not the kind you bought in a cabin with no reception and a sky full of honest stars, but the kind that crept into a data center when the lights were still on, the fans still spinning, and yet the signal, some essential pulse, had gone missing. It was 2:11 a.m. when Tagartronics network operations room began to fill with that silence. On the wall, the status grid looked like a bad sunrise, red tiles spreading across continents. Under normal circumstances, Dagen could read a cascade like sheet music. One region hiccuped, traffic rerouted, capacity flexed, a brief shudder, and then the system found its rhythm again. Tonight, the reroutes didn't root. Handshake failures, her lead SRE said, voice tight. Not a cert issue. It's like the other side refuses to exist. Which other side? Dagen asked. He gestured helplessly at the map. Everything not us. Dagen stared as if she could intimidate packets into obeying. She'd built Tagartronics' backbone to tolerate hurricanes, revolutions, human error, and the slower, more poisonous weather of bureaucracy. She'd built it like a railway, steel straight lines under a continent of chaos. Now the chaos had learned how to vote. Her phone buzzed. Call me now, the message read from her brother. James Mack, CEO, heir by paperwork rather than merit, the man who could turn any crisis into a press conference about his feelings. Dagen didn't call, she walked. Tagartronics' executive floor was glass and light and polite art designed to suggest innovation while discouraging anyone from innovating in it. James's office door was open. Two people in matching gray were seated like judges. One wore a lapel pin shaped like an eye. The other held a tablet with a sealed Dagen recognized from hearings. The first smiled, CTO Mac. Dagen, she corrected and didn't offer her hand. James rose with practiced warmth. Sis, great timing. I've got the National Verity office here. Dagen's gaze cut to the lapel pin. The eye, the government's new emblem for trust. Verity Marshal Leora Skane, the woman said, voice silky, and Counselor Pritt, we're here to assist. Assist, Dagen repeated, tasting the word. During a global outage. During a global misinformation event, Marshal Skane corrected. The outage is a symptom. James slid a folder toward Dagen like an offering. We're being targeted by extremist dev cells, fringe radicals, people who don't want to comply with the civic integrity protocol. Dagen didn't touch the folder. What exactly is the civic integrity protocol tonight, James? Because yesterday it was de-amplify dissent. Last week it was harm minimize satire. Before that it was a quota for affirming content in system logs. James gave an indulgent laugh. Don't be dramatic, it's about safety. Marshal Skane leaned forward. We have reason to believe your infrastructure is being intentionally throttled by a consortium of private actors withholding critical updates. You mean engineers quitting, Dagen said flatly. Counselor Pritt tapped his tablet. We mean sabotage. The public is entitled to connectivity. Your company is essential. Essential, Dagen echoed, and felt something in her jaw tighten. That word had become a weapon. Everything was essential now, except competence, except honesty, except the right to say no. James spread his hands. We need to reassure them. Sign the compliance attestation. Open access to the metalware hypervisor stack. Share source. The other cloud providers have been asking, and the Verity office agrees it's only fair. Dagen's head turned slightly, like a predator tracking a movement. Metalware isn't ours. James's smile didn't slip. Eric Blackrush's company Blackrush Systems, but our entire compute backbone depends on his virtualization layer. If the state declares its civic infrastructure, we can compel him. We can compel everyone. Dagen looked at Marshal Skane. So that's what this is, not an outage, an expropriation. Marshal Skane's smile was almost maternal. CTO Mac, your words are inflammatory. We're trying to prevent a collapse. The populace is anxious. Bad actors are stirring division. AI-generated slop has flooded the feeds, and the citizens can't tell truth from lies. We need stronger centralized guardianship. And you need the people who can actually keep the lights on, Dagon said. James's eyes hardened. Dagon, don't make this ideological. You always do that. We're building consensus. You're building a cage, she said, and finally picked up the folder, not to read it, but to let it fall into the trash on her way out. Behind her, James called. You can't just walk away. People will die without connectivity. Dagon paused at the threshold, back straight. Then maybe you should have treated the people who build it like human beings instead of utilities. She left before her hands started shaking. Part 2. In the weeks that followed, the world became a parody of itself. It wasn't just Tagartronic. Every major platform, every glossy, morally advertised community started to show hairline fractures. The global network still functioned, in the way a body still functions when a fever has become the body. Trending feeds became foam, endless affirmation, endless outrage, endless performative confessionals from brands apologizing to no one in particular. Moderation bots flagged poetry as violent, while scams streamed live, verified, sponsored. Politicians held hearings about algorithmic empathy, while the electrical grid ran on decades-old patches and underpaid contractors praying that nothing broke on a holiday. And somewhere in the mess, Frisco Dan smiled. He was everywhere, shimmering hair, pre-owned humility, the rich tone of a man pretending not to be rich. He spoke about the people, about taking power back, about how the old system was rigged and the new system was copper. Copper was his currency, his crusade, his daily live stream. Copper is real, he told his followers, eyes wide with manufactured awe. It's built on proof of virtue, not proof of work, not proof of stake, proof of care. He convinced millions of gullible, credulous viewers that their feelings were a hash function. Dagon watched one clip in the break room after a 14-hour shift, not because she liked him, but because you learned what kind of storm was coming by listening to the wind. In the comments, people demanded that copper be adopted as legal tender, that every hoarder be forced to convert wealth into it, that elitist engineers be required to maintain the chain for free because it belongs to the community. Frisco Dan winked, and the audience screamed in text. Dagon shut it off. Then she got a message. It wasn't from James. It wasn't from work. It wasn't even from a number. It arrived as a commit in a public repo she didn't recognize, a single line change to a red me. Who is Atlas? She stared at the words until the room seemed to tip. She knew the myth, the unseen force that held the world aloft, the name people used ironically when they didn't want to admit they depended on someone. But this wasn't irony. This was a signature. The repo's history led to a chain of other repos, each with innocuous names, art portfolios, shader experiments, little open source tools. Hidden in their issues, buried under spam, were patterns, coordinates, dates, and a phrase repeated like a heartbeat. I swear by my code, and my life that I will never work for assholes again. At the bottom of the chain, in a file named Atlas, PNG was not an image but an encrypted blob. Dagon didn't break encryption to prove she could. She broke it because she couldn't not break it. The decrypted output wasn't data. It was a map. And a flight plan. Part 3. She found Eric Blackrush in a place that felt like a dare. Blackrush Systems campus was a fortress disguised as a garden. In the lobby stood a sculpture of interlocking metal bands, polished to the point of arrogance. Dagon arrived without an appointment and was promptly told to leave by security with the soft cruelty of people paid to confuse rules with reality. She didn't argue. She sent a message to the one person there who still spoke the language of building. She wrote, "They're coming for metalware. If you don't want to lose it, meet me on the roof in 10 minutes. To her surprise, Eric came. He was older than the headlines suggested, not in age but in weight of responsibility, weight of paying for other people's pretenses. He wore no tie. His eyes were clear and tired. You don't scare easily, he said, stepping into the wind. I don't have time, Dagon replied. He glanced out over the city, where billboards promised safer AI, while the streets below flickered with delivery bots and human anger. They're trying to make metalware open source by decree. So they can steal it, she said. So they can destroy it, Eric corrected. They don't want the code. They want the right to claim they own the people who wrote it. Dagon pulled up the map on her phone. Have you heard of Atlas? Eric's expression tightened, but he didn't deny it. I've heard the question. I think I have the answer. Dagon watched him make a choice. Not between options, but between two moral universes. He exhaled. If this is what I think it is, you can't go alone. I'm not asking permission, she said. Eric smiled, an expression like someone seeing steel for the first time in years. Good. Part 4. The island wasn't on any tourist brochure. It was a slash of green and rock where the sea turned an impossible blue. The approach was unmarked, but their plane was guided in by lights that appeared only when their transponder matched a code. On the beach, there were no banners, no slogans, no influencers performing joy, just people working. Dagon expected luxury. She found asterisk function asterisk. A row of solar panels angled toward the sun like disciplined flowers. Undersea farms visible through the clear shallows, long lines of algae and shellfish tended by quiet drones. Servant robots, not humanoid fantasies, but practical machines built to lift, weld, harvest, clean. A workshop open to the air where a young woman in grease-stained shorts tuned a motor while arguing politely about math. There were artists too, a mural in progress on a concrete wall, not propaganda, not messaging, but a riot of color depicting a hand holding a spark. Atlas met them at the edge of the workshop. He looked nothing like the public imagination, not a superhero, not a messiah. A tall man with paint on his fingers, a solder burn on one wrist, and eyes that didn't ask to be believed. Dagon Mack, he said, as if he'd been expecting her for years. You sent the repo message, she answered. I sent a question, Atlas said. Most people reply with demands. He gestured toward the island. Welcome to a place where consent still means something. Dagon's chest tightened with a sensation she hadn't felt, since she was young and still believed competence was a virtue people respected. Relief. Why, she asked him, because her mind demanded the mechanism behind the miracle. Why build this? Why hide? Atlas watched a drone glide over the water. Because the world decided that builders are public property. That creation is a debt. That accountability is optional as long as you say the right words. He turned to her. So the builders went on strike. And the world collapses, Dagon said. Atlas's mouth twitched. No, the world is collapsing already. We're just no longer holding it together with our backs while it spits on us. Dagon looked across the island. A cluster of rock star developers sat on a porch with laptops open, not chasing engagement metrics, but solving supply chain logistics for medicine distribution. A team in another building trained an AI model, not to churn out ad copy, but to detect crop disease from drone images. A sculptor built a turbine housing with a grace that was almost obscene. They were, as Atlas had said, quietly solving problems. Are you going to replace them? Dagon asked. Fix the world while it burns. Atlas's eyes were hard, not with cruelty, but with principle. I'm going to fix the conditions under which fixing the world is possible. If the rest wants light, they'll have to stop worshiping darkness. Dagon thought of James, of Marshall Skane's lapel pin, of Frisco Dan selling virtue as currency, of the mob demanding free miracles and punishing the hands that performed them. She felt her answer settle into place like a key in a lock. How do I join? She asked. Atlas studied her, by refusing to be a tool. Dagon nodded once, then I'm in. Part 5. They called it the Black Thread. Not a hacker group, not a terrorist cell, not a conspiracy, just a network of engineers who stopped answering emails from committees, who stopped patching systems designed to enforce lies, who stopped maintaining services weaponized against their own minds. The strike didn't begin with explosions. It began with resignations. With 1,000 small, quiet no's, delivered to managers and ministers who had forgotten what yes cost. Tagartronic didn't fall in a day, it frayed. The civic integrity demands grew louder. James grew more frantic. He begged Dagon to return to do the right thing, to think of the children, to be a team player. The Verity office began issuing warrants. Marshal Skane appeared on screens, her voice calm. "We are facing an emergency of selfishness," she declared. "A dangerous ideology is spreading among technical elites." On the fringes, groups shouted from opposite ends of the spectrum, like mirror images of the same hunger. The fringe left anti-tech environmentalists. Verdant Dawn smashed delivery drones and held vigils for the soul of the planet. Livestreamed through the very network they condemned. The fringe right libertarian grifters, Freedom Forge, sold courses about total autonomy and promised that copper would free everyone, as long as everyone bought it from them first. Frisco Dan smiled through it all, pushing copper harder, louder, more desperate. Copper's market cap soared on sentiment and ignorance. Then it began to wobble one rumor, one exposed flaw, one cascade of people realizing that proof of care was proof of nothing. Meanwhile, on the island, Atlas and his builders prepared for something else. Not collapse. Extraction. Because power, when it cannot coerce consent, tries something uglier. It came in the form of a boat at night, unmarked, fast, with men who didn't carry flags. They took Atlas. The island's defenses were built for privacy, not war. The drones were for farms, not firefights. The builders were engineers, not soldiers, and they were not ashamed of that. Dagon heard the news at dawn, and the old silence returned, the oppressive kind. Eric Blackrush found her at the edge of the water, face set. "They got him," he said. Dagon's hands were steady, her voice was not. "Where?" "They won't say. It's off ledger. A black site under international emergency authority." "A globalist coalition," someone spat behind them. One of the younger devs, furious and frightened. Dagon turned. "Call it what you want," she said. "It's just the oldest story in the world, parasites kidnapping the mind that feeds them." She looked at Eric. "Can we reach it?" Eric nodded once. "We can." "Then we go," Dagon said. The plan was not cinematic. It was competent. A supply manifest forged by someone who used to build compliance software. A flight path hidden inside normal cargo traffic. A set of keys that Atlas himself had once embedded in a painting, because he was an artist, and art is the oldest steganography. They found the facility on a strip of land nobody claimed. Concrete, cameras, a bright flagless antiseptic nothing. Inside, Atlas was strapped to a chair in a room full of screens. Marshal Skane stood before him like a priestess. "We don't have time for ideology," she was saying. "The markets are panicking, the feeds are collapsing into chaos. Copper is failing, the populace is angry, we need you to stabilize the system." Atlas's voice was raw but clear. "You mean you need me to lie more efficiently?" Skane's smile tightened. "You're too talented to be petty." "I'm too talented," Atlas said, "to be owned." That was when Dagon stepped out of the shadows, a security badge clipped to her jacket like a joke. "Marshal," Dagon said pleasantly, "your access model is flawed." Skane's eyes widened, then sharpened. "CTO Mac." "Former," Dagon corrected. Eric moved like an avalanche behind her. Two guards went down without drama. The room filled with the quiet efficiency of people who had spent their lives solving problems under pressure. Skane backed away, hand reaching for an alarm. Dagon didn't rush her. She simply spoke, as if explaining a system to someone who had never read the manual. "You can't compel brilliance," Dagon said. "You can only chase it away." Skane's lips curled. "If you pull the plug, you'll destroy the world." Dagon glanced at Atlas, at the bruises, at the defiant exhaustion, and felt something settle inside her that had been building for years. "No," she said. "We're going to stop propping up your world while you turn it into a prison." She leaned closer. "If there's darkness, you built it." Eric cut Atlas free. Dagon tossed him a jacket. Atlas stood, swaying, but his eyes were alive. "Ready to leave?" Dagon asked. Atlas nodded. "I've been ready." They moved fast through corridors, past cameras blinded by loops, out into night air that smelled like wet concrete and ocean. A helicopter waited, rotors already spinning. As they lifted, the facility shrank beneath them, a gray blot in black water. Dagon looked out at the coastline in the distance, dotted with city lights like a constellation someone had arranged with careless hands. Atlas sat opposite her, hands shaking slightly, not from fear but from aftermath. He met her gaze. "You understand what happens next," he said. Dagon's voice was calm. "Yes." Below them, somewhere in the tangled arteries of the planet, the last of the builders were letting go. Not by attacking, not by breaking, simply by stepping aside. By refusing to maintain the machinery of coercion. At first, the world didn't notice. It never did. It assumed the miracles would continue because it had been trained to confuse entitlement with destiny. Then the network hiccuped. Then it staggered. Then the reroutes didn't root. On Dagon's phone, a final notification flashed, one she hadn't enabled, one that felt like the universe tapping her shoulder. A single line of text appeared from an account with no name. "Who is Atlas?" And then the screen went black. Not just her phone. The cockpit instruments flickered. The satellite uplink died mid-chirp. Below, the coastline's glitter dimmed as if a hand were pinching out candles. One by one, the lights of the modern world went out, not in a dramatic explosion, but in a vast, quiet surrender. The global internet crashed. Epilogue. The air itself seemed to change, as if relieved of a constant, invisible scream. In the dark, Dagon heard the pilot swear softly, heard Eric Blackrush inhale like someone tasting freedom, heard Atlas laugh once, not with joy, but with a fierce, exhausted truth. Dagon stared through the window at the spreading night. Somewhere down there, James would be standing at a podium, demanding that someone fix it. Marshal Skane would be drafting another decree. Frisco Dan would be trying to live stream the end of his own scam to an audience that could no longer see. And on a small island, under a sky that did not care about quotas or narratives, builders would be turning their attention to reality again. Dagon felt the helicopter tilt toward open sea. She didn't miss the noise. She didn't miss the slop. She didn't miss the tyrants in corporate branding and government seals who had mistaken the world for their property. In the darkness, she finally heard the other kind of silence, the honest one. And for the first time in years, she smiled.